This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to iFanboys Talksplode with Gabriel Hardman and Karina Becco.
I know what she's going to do, and I can't wait for her to do it. She knows me, and I know her. What I hate and what I prefer.
Hey, this is Josh Lanigan from iFanboy.com, and this is Talksplode, our creator interview podcast. This is the first reward in our Patreon goals. We said if we reach a certain level, we would start doing these more regularly, say once a month. So here's the first one, and we thank all the patrons for that. Make sure you go over to patreon.com/ifanboy, and you can see how that works. But this is also fun for us, too, so it's totally cool. Today we're talking to Gabriel Hardman and Karina Becco. They are a creative team and a husband and wife. They make comics together. They're currently working on Invisible Republic from Image Comics. Previously, they've done Heathen Town and a bunch of other stuff, Star Wars and Planet of the Apes, good stuff. I always love talking to Gabe, and I always love talking to Karina, so let's get right to it. And I'm here with Karina Becco.
Hello.
Hi. And Gabriel Hardman.
Hello, Josh.
I'm also going to give you a high-pitched hi, because I don't want to be gender-specific on that. I was worried that I might have been doing that. Husband and wife, creative team, you produce comics together, and I've talked to Gabe a lot on here, but I haven't talked to Karina on this. Have I ever had you in the video show? Have you ever talked professionally?
I don't believe so. I don't think so, actually.
The only time I was on here was with Jeff Parker, like, 5 years ago or something.
You were in the video show once, too.
Okay,
so if you said that so. Also, and then Goodfellas. It's okay.
All right, yes, I was on Goodfellas, but that doesn't count.
It's true, but basically, like, I don't know anything about her, so you can just go in the room for a half an hour or so, we're going to chat, and then you can come back after that. I think it's totally fair. I do actually know, I think I know Gabe's sort of comics origin story from listening to Jim Viscardi's show, Let's Talk Comics, and if you haven't listened to that, you absolutely should, and I don't want to cover a lot of that same ground, but... I know that you two have been together a while. Karina, did you know comics before Gabe, or what's your sort of start with comics?
Well, actually, there wasn't a whole lot before him. So, we lived together since I was 19.
Yeah.
So he was already embarking on a comics career when I moved in, though. So I guess that there was a little bit of time of reading Love and Rockets and things in high school, but I got a first row seat to a lot of comics real early because we lived together.
And how did that, at what point did you, did you become a fan of it of your own accord, or did you have to be sort of like they were around and eventually that became something that you were interested in? Because, you've done comics of your own right all at this point now, and you're writing them and you're doing all sorts of things, so you've definitely developed something for them. What was your part of it, I suppose?
Oh, absolutely. I've always been a really omnivorous reader, so I read a lot of stuff in high school, and I just, if things are around, I will generally read them. But a lot of my taste, I think, was formed because we lived in Manhattan, which was really lucky. So there was a lot more variety to be found. And plus, we got deliveries of every single thing, pretty much.
Yeah, this was in the early 90s, when, or mid-90s, I guess, when I worked for Marvel. And so they literally gave me a giant stack of every single thing that came out every week.
Which was amazing. So I just read all of it.
That's a really rough time to start reading comics.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it seems like it from this, remove, when there's a lot more indie comics and a lot more things that are maybe, to my taste, easily available. But at the same time, it was a really good education to just read a ton of stuff, because there's stuff that you don't even remember that they put out, I bet, that I read. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of an interesting way to get into it, in a way, because I was, I also read all of the stuff like Sandman and all of those things.
It was a great time for Vertigo.
As I remember it, that Game of You, I think it's called, was just one something that, was in the stack.
It was stuck in there. I was like, what's this?
The James Robinson Starman and stuff like that. I mean, there were interesting things to be had at the time.
That's true. Kind of what people think of now, they almost think of those things as separate, whereas I was reading everything all mixed together and pulling those out as, here's the interesting stuff. But it wasn't handed to me as, here's the interesting stuff. I got to kind of discover that it was interesting.
So what?
Because I didn't care about any of it. I was like, I was totally uninterested and like, this is all garbage. And I wasn't encouraging any of this.
That's interesting. So what was the first sort of thing that really spoke to you, that grabbed you, that you thought, this is a great thing? Or was that something else that wasn't in that stack?
Well, actually, I guess the very first thing that I was really, I guess it kind of counts as comics, was probably the gory stuff that I read as a kid. Mm-hmm. I guess that counts as it's comics adjacent. But I guess really it was the Game of You and Neil Gaiman stuff that I really latched on to.
And Harvey Pekar.
Oh, and Harvey Pekar, of course. But I think I came to that on my own, just finding old issues of American Splendor at the local comic shop.
And what were you into at that time, Gabe?
I was lying about that stuff where I said everything was bad.
I got you.
Yeah. Everybody might not. I don't know. I was interested in that stuff. I mean, if I'm going to be perfectly honest, I was starting to be less interested in the Vertigo stuff by this point. Like I'd read all that stuff from the beginning. Like I read Sandman from issue one, just, as a reader. And I was a huge fan of the Morrison Doom Patrol and Animal Man. And I guess that stuff was all pre-Vertigo. But it,
I'm taking it back. That was actually a great time for comics, if you knew what to look for.
Yeah.
So it's just that you don't, you think of it in a, it's almost like you think of it as a monolith. And it really wasn't.
No, I don't, not at all.
You in the abstract sense. Yeah.
And it was also the tail end of black and white comics and stuff like that. And I mean, I had been, so I'd read all that stuff as the sort of pre-Vertigo stuff. And I'm too young to have read the Alan Moore Swamp Thing when it came out, or I bought a copy when I was 10 and I thought it was awful.
Right.
I wasn't at the time, I was not the audience. And, by this point, by the 90s and, stuff, I was less and less interested in that. I mean, I was starting to kind of grow away from it, because for me, a lot of that stuff, the stuff that worked for me the best was stuff that I read when I was like 14, 15, 16, and it was, kind of adolescent. Like, I feel like that about the Morrison Doom Patrol. It was a great sort of thing for me at that moment, when I loved the Velvet Underground, when I was, interested in,
art and music and all that
stuff. No, when I was first exposed to all of that stuff, I think I was first exposed to all that stuff at the, and the Morrison Doom Patrol and stuff like that was part of that. And, by the time I was working in comics, stuff like Hellboy had started up. I certainly read Sin City, but I was not a fan of it. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of things in that, in this one little bubble of time where people were trying to make new and different things, even though everybody remembers it as just this, this wash of what at the time was, you know, kind of garbagey books from, you know, Marvel and DC, but also from Image.
Were you aware of, I mean, I know that you have a very finely honed sense of what you think is good and what is bad, but like, were you aware of what was actually good at that point? And I only say that because I know you were really young, and yeah. When you're young, you're stupid, and what you think is really good. And you have very, not you, again, this is the collective you, you have a very strong sense of what is good and bad, but you were also working in it professionally at the time. So I'm wondering sort of how that clouds your critical view of stuff.
Well, I mean, how honest do I be? You know, like, how honest should I be? I mean, like, now the thing was, I wasn't a fan of the, I mean, you know, yes, you're right. I mean, I was young and it was, you know, and you don't have good ideas when you're young. But in, for me, those ideas come out as I hate everything. So, I mean, like, I was not in any way a fan of the, of what was fashionable art-wise at that time, you know, those early Image guys. And I felt like I had, you know, I'm like sitting over the corner reading Hitchcock Truffaut and thinking I got all these ideas about storytelling, and the stuff I'm doing is garbage at the time. You know, mm-hmm. It's not like I was doing anything any good, but when I did not like the rest of that stuff. I mean, there were certain, obviously there are people that, you know, people who did quality work and who had, you know, kind of, you know, solid, obvious talents like Jim Lee or whoever, but they're, you know, but none of that stuff was for me, and certainly none of the kind of really adolescent aspect of the of those Image books, those early Image books, was for me. I didn't feel like I was, you know, I was 19, 20 or whatever when those were coming out, and I wasn't, you know, 13 or whatever would really strike somebody. So, I mean, a lot of that was not for me, and I felt like I wanted to, you know, what I wanted to do back then was Vertigo books. Like what I was, you know, I that was what would have been exciting for me, was doing something that felt more like, you know, the kind of thing that I would read. I mean, what I did draw back then was War Machine and a few other things. It didn't do anything for me. It was a job, and it was, you know, a way into doing this. And, you know, and I love comics, and I loved, you know, I loved having the opportunity to work in them. But story-wise, those books didn't speak to me.
What were you into comics-wise? And it doesn't have to be from that time, you know, it doesn't have to be from that, but, like, what was the work that you really admired in comics, like, at that age?
I liked a lot of the stuff. I mean, I still really admired Neil Adams, who I, you know, found when I was a teenager and really, you know, and loved his stuff, and it was a point where I was discovering more things, like Gene Colan's Tomb of Dracula stuff, and
which was so much harder then.
Yeah,
to discover things, and I always think back to that.
Yeah, absolutely, and certainly, and it, you know, it involved stumbling upon something in a bin at St. Mark's Comics.
Yeah, you couldn't just order it on Amazon.
Yeah.
It wasn't so easy.
And
probably easier for us being in a metropolitan.
Much center. Easier for you, trust me.
Yeah, and it. I mean. You know, and there were just so few collections. It was just a rarity for something to be collected. Mm-hmm. And
it was so exciting when things started getting collected. It's so much easier.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff I did, those War Machine books I did in the 90s weren't collected until a couple of years ago.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
But I was also really into, you know, I mean, the thing for me when talking about this is, and talking about influences and comics, is that, like, I know this is the case for Karina as well, but for both writing and art, I have loads of influences, and I'm mostly looking other places for inspiration than comics, because I feel like the stalest thing in the world is to just look within the medium you're working in for, for guidance and for, you know, for inspiration. I mean, I like to look outside of that, at illustration, at
sure,
you know, at other, you know, at fine art, at films, at all sorts of stuff.
I know that. I think the question is more along the lines of, like, I'm curious what comics you looked at from any era when you were that age, because I know that now you know a lot more than you did then. But yeah, like at that point, what was it that you looked at that those are good comics? Whether you want to do comics like those or use them as influence or not, I'm just right, curious what was.
Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, I think it was stuff that I've, a lot of stuff that I've already talked about, the yeah, Morrison Doom Patrol, Animal Man, I love that book. Although I didn't, you know, I didn't look, I, both of those, you know, the artists on those are great and they absolutely work for what they did, but they, but well, they weren't books I looked to as, you know, yeah, the templates. But
Swamp Thing,
you know, Swamp Thing, I mean, you know, Hellboy, and I, you know, I'm coming up blank with a lot of other specifics for things, but I know, I'm sure there were superhero books as well. I mean, I'm sure that, well,
my follow up for that would be, and what of those things do you still think is really good today?
Well, Hellboy's good. You know, I mean, Mike McDowell is great. And
that's true. Not a risky answer, but that's
yeah,
true.
this is where I'm just a politician.
You're like that, but, that good stuff. It's really good.
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, I don't, I mean, I look back at the Morrison Doom Patrol stuff and I think, well, that was for a teenager, you know? And I think, and
it's a little different looking at it now because a lot of stuff that's copied it has come in between, I feel
yeah,
like.
Yeah.
So I think that's always the case. Like you see something that was the first of something, even if you're, you know, you're seeing it now, you're like, oh, this doesn't seem as fresh. Well, a lot of people have copied it.
Yeah.
I call that the All in the Family effect.
Right.
Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
And one thing that I mean, something like a very mainstream thing that I loved was the Justice League, the Giffen, DeMatteis, Kevin Maguire Justice League. And I mean, you know, that, and that was certainly something that I felt like that was a, I mean, that was like a high quality book that was doing something different, and I really liked it. And I have never really gone back and tried to read it again. Exactly. You know, I mean, like I would rather that yeah, live in the yeah, world of, I loved it when I was a kid.
I understand that completely. And did you two have, did you like similar things or did you like different things? Like, do you have, cause I know that you work together now and we'll get towards that, but I'm curious, like at that time, like, were there a lot, was there a big dovetail in sort of the stuff that you enjoyed at the time?
There's a lot of crossover, but I think I lean more towards, I'll really like, you know, dark fantasy, horror stuff. You like that, you like the horror end of things too, but
yeah,
I think I'll accept and enjoy a lot more fantasy tinged or science, like soft sci-fi stuff maybe. And
yeah, I mean, I like, and I think that my tastes go in a slightly different direction, but I mean, there's a lot of overlap, but I mean, and I think that also you're much wider read than I am. And I know lots more movies than you do.
Yeah, that's probably true. That's fair.
And therefore together you are unstoppable.
We try.
Now, I'd be foolish not to touch on this, but Karina, you had a career prior to comics that is very fascinating, and I think it makes its way into your work also. So can you tell us a little about you and animals?
Oh yeah, I had a rather circuitous route to writing comics. I went to school for zoology, and I spent time working as a research assistant, looking at behavioral research in LA Zoo. I've been a zookeeper, and I've worked as in a wildlife rescue hospital that was like an emergency hospital for, you know, hawks and sea lions and things like that. So a lot of animals make it into my writing.
I like how that stuck with you. And I mean, it actually goes across all the work that you've both done. And that's really fascinating. Also, I bet you have not run into one other person at a comic convention who was tabling, who had the same background.
Not exactly the same background, but I was very pleased recently to meet up with somebody who was a paleontological illustrator. So I think there's some of us out there that are into stuff like this.
I think that works really well. So at what point did you two decide we want to work together on something? Now, I think Heathentown would have been the first thing that you did that was published.
Yes.
Yes,
and that was mid 2000s, late 2008, no, something
2009.
Like that.
2009.
Okay,
yeah. Early 2009. Yeah.
So yeah. was that the first thing? You thought, hey, why don't we do something? Or was, you know, there's stuff bubbling for years?
Yeah, we talked about it for a long time, and we've gone to San Diego Comic-Con like how many years in a row?
Yeah,
I hate
like
to say how many.
Since 1995, I think.
Yeah, and I think pretty much every time we went there, we kind of said we should do something together, because I wrote stuff, you know, I've written nonfiction stuff and fiction prose and stuff like that, and we always talked about it, and then we finally just the stars aligned so that we both had the time and the right, I don't know, mood.
Well, I mean, it was also because you had your you went to school and, you know, graduated, had these animal oriented jobs, and
which can be pretty intense. I mean, not a lot of time for extra stuff with some of that.
And I, you know, I had a career as a storyboard artist that for, 10 years straight from as soon as I left comics in 1996 to 2006, I worked almost nonstop all the time, you know, for a, you know, freelancer. But, you know, when I'd finish a movie, another movie come up, I'd start on that and I'd just keep going forever. And so, it's also a very intense career. And had spent, and had always wanted to do other things and do things that were more personally creative. And, I've talked about it before, but at the end of a very stressful movie that I worked on for a really long time, I had, I had just felt like I got to do something different. And Karina had the story for Heathen Town, and we basically kind of worked on it together, and I adapted it into the comic. And
it was after a very intense and stressful period of the job I was at as well.
Yeah,
so
it needed
a break.
Yeah, we had both worked on super intense jobs separately, and then it was a stressful, difficult time, and we ended up collaborating on the thing together after that, not as some sort of intentional thing or some way to, spend time together or anything. It was more just like,
yeah, God forbid.
I'm going to go back and read it now. Just look for all. Oh, it's all here. It's right there.
but no, it's just, it just ended up working out that way. And at that, it took a couple of years for us to get the book published and be serious about getting it published. So,
but we did. We got it all done just for our own, to our own satisfaction, before we even tried to get it published. It was kind of just a thing, like, let's see if we can do this and make it work.
Yeah.
So did that get, did that see print before you started working at Marvel again?
No, I don't think so. I think Mark Panisha at Marvel saw either some stuff from that or some other stuff that was online. Maybe he saw pages from Heathen Town. I don't know. Or maybe Jeff Parker saw them. I don't know. But somebody from there did and called me up about doing some of the something, like the little jobs that I did at Marvel initially. I don't know. It was just a thing where we made a deal to publish Heathen Town with Jim Valentino at, Image Shadow Line. And the turnaround from when we made the deal to when it was actually published, I had already done a bunch of Marvel books in the,
comics you'd drawn in quite a while.
Yeah, Heathen Town was definitely the first comics I'd drawn since, and I think it really shows, since the mid 90s, since the prequel to Independence Day, which was the last comic I did.
That's right, I forgot. Oh my gosh.
How did it compare to that work, though?
Honestly, I feel like that Independence Day prequel is pretty strong. especially the part where somebody went back and redrew all of Bill Pullman's heads on that I had drawn. I can't remember what the deal was with that, except I'm pretty sure that I met that guy at some point at a con.
And do you ever find yourself out and you run into Bill Pullman somewhere and just look at his hands and just, damn it.
No.
Damn it. No. Well, that could happen someday. And that thought is going to pop in your head, and I'm going to be part of it. And I like that. So what made you want to go back to comics then?
Oh, just deep, deep frustration with where I was in movies. I mean, you know, I had just finished working on the most expensive movie ever made, and it was incredibly intense, but I didn't, you know, I'm working for the director. I'm not, you know, I'm not getting any real creative satisfaction out of it, despite putting an enormous amount of creative work into it, and certainly not getting any credit for that work.
Had it been in your mind that I'm gonna do comics again someday?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. You know, there was never a point where I thought that I wasn't going to do comics anymore. It wasn't even a clear career move to move into storyboards. It was I wanted to work in films and I, you know, want to make films, but the working in storyboards was a kind of happenstance sort of thing. And I went into it and I was real serious about it. And I had been a movie nerd for, you know, since I was a teenager. And so I had read tons about filmmaking. So, and applied all that to working in storyboards. But it was when I got into it was when the comic business collapsed.
I was going to say it's a perfect, like, you were out of it exactly the right time to not be in it.
Yeah,
it was a good jump to make.
It was dumb luck. And, you know, and I went, we went to the San Diego Comic-Con the following year. And, you know, and I'm going around talking to people who are desperate and don't have any money and looking for jobs. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I just worked on this movie called Austin Powers. And, you know, and everybody's like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about.
Did you have any comics contacts left over?
No, not at all. Like,
none of those people.
Oh, well, I mean, Hank Canals, who's at DC Comics still, is somebody who's still in comics, who I know, but even he had gotten out of comics for several years after that.
Yeah,
he had worked.
Everybody we knew.
Yeah. I mean, he had worked at Malibu and I'd worked with him there, but, almost everybody else was, pretty much everybody I knew then was out of comics really soon after that.
Now, let's zip forward a little bit, and I mean, I guess you could say your opus that's going on now is Invisible Republic, and you know, I was almost like, where did that come from? But I still kind of want to know where that came from, because I mean, this is the larger scope than anything. It's a big thing.
Yeah,
was that sort of in a nascent stage for a really long time?
Fuck yes,
a long time.
Long time. Like it was, the germ of the idea was about, and you know, Invisible Republic, if somebody listening hasn't, you know, doesn't know anything about it, is this kind of a big sort of political science fiction epic. And it starts, the kind of instigator of the story is this confrontation between a couple of refugees and some soldiers on a beach. And that initial concept of taking that situation of the soldiers and the refugees and the beach and that whole thing and that confrontation, that the germ of that idea had been knocking around for a really long time, and the idea of making it a science fiction thing was knocking around for a really long time, and I'm sure earlier it was, you know, at earlier points, it was much more of a science fiction thing than it is now. You know, my tastes tend to beat things down into people wearing cargo pants and in shitty clothes and a very limited amount of fantastical stuff. But it's something that we had talked about for years and years and years. And not only that, it was something that we started working on immediately after Heathentown. I drew.
That's right. Not really in production, but at least.
Well, no, I drew the entire first issue of it immediately after Heathentown.
Yeah, that's true.
And we went back and completely revised that. I mean, there are some bits and pieces that survive into the first issue of Invisible Republic. But that was we had that whole issue and showed it to Jim Valentino at the same time we were making the deal for Heathentown. Hmm. But then I got kind of diverted into doing the Marvel stuff, and we were always sort. And then,
and you were exclusive for a year, even.
Yeah, that was great. And and then that was a very important part of my career.
Everyone's
and so,
doing it.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And so, like, uh, I, you know, I did that. I did Hulk, and I did, you know, another book, and then Karina and I started writing freelance stuff together, mm-hmm. and you know, and then the freelance stuff kept, you know, becoming the thing that kept us from doing what became Invisible Republic. So, like, it was something that we, you know, that was sort of our dream thing that we never wanted to do until we could totally control it, because we knew that if we could. Doing it the way we wanted to do it was probably not the way that somebody else would let us do it.
Mm-hmm. Where did the germ of that idea come from between the two? Because I know this because my wife and I will have conversations about stuff all the time, and we're both relatively creative, and we'll hit on a thing and then start to talk about it and develop it into a comedy television series that no one's ever going to make, so it doesn't go anywhere. But I'm wondering, like, where the germ of that came from, because it's very specific, but I can't. It doesn't feel like an analogy to anything real.
It actually, the very smallest seed of it came from a folk song. And
seriously?
Yeah.
No, that's a great answer. That's what I was like, wow, I wasn't expecting to hear that.
Yeah, well, and that kind of grew, the idea that a lot of those songs go through multiple generations and they mean something different to each new generation that will use it for a different struggle or a different crisis or a different, set of problems, a different government even. So the idea that you could take that and those same things that happen to people and that they struggle against, and it could have happened in the past, it could be contemporary, or it could be far in the future. I think that kind of was the genesis.
The song is you know, it's called different things because the way that sort of folk tradition works, people take the, you know, the lyrics and they make different songs out of it, and they, you know,
yeah, sometimes
it evolves.
It's the music that stays, and sometimes it's snatches of the lyrics, but sometimes it's just almost the lyrics will change completely, but it'll still sort of mean the same thing.
Yeah, and this is a song. The name Arthur McBride, one of the, you know, central characters, and it comes from the song, and it's about, you know, and it's basically it's a song that's more or less about a confrontation on the beach between a soldier and some people on a beach, and
there's a great Bob Dylan rendition that we both really like,
but taking that and saying, I mean, you know, the song itself is sort of a rebellious song. It's basically a fuck you to authority song. And, you know, and it's been, you know, more or less used that way. Although there are versions of it where, you know, where the entire confrontation where they beat the shit out of the soldiers and kill them is sort of a fantasy that's sort of revealed at the end of the song. But, you know, but we wanted to take that and not say, this is a simplistic situation where, you know, where some soldiers came along and, you know, and our scrappy heroes, you know, beat the shit out of them and told them they weren't going to join up. You know, we wanted to take it and make it something that had moral and, you know, complexity to it and had and where it wasn't entirely clear that that our heroes are, you know, like have, you know, are. You know,
human.
Yeah, or just they're not black and white characters, you know.
And it's always an interesting thing too if you look at if you have the perspective of history where the power lies, because of course it depends on which side you're on and what you perceive as the power. So to see how that power would arise and how someone would use it and what they think they can do with it as opposed to what they actually do with it is an interesting question.
And a lot of the times the song is called Arthur McBride, and we had called the book Arthur McBride for a long time. But
nobody liked that.
Yeah, nobody liked that. But still, the point, though, was more that he's not the main character.
No.
The main character is his female cousin, and she's the one we follow through his story, and she's the one who is kind of the crux of, you know, the reporter investigating it, that she had been somehow wiped out of the history of this planet, and that there had been this strong central woman who had played this enormous part in reshaping the history of this planet, but it had been completely wiped away, like happens a lot in the world. And however, we've had many Hollywood oriented meetings about this this book, and inevitably none of them can understand that the man that Arthur McBride is not the main character,
despite the fact that it's literally huge sections of the book are written in a diary written by Maya,
the female character, from her point of view.
He's nearly a background character.
Yeah.
Which is very obvious. I don't think
they
read
it. And he's a black box. Like, you can't, like, we never see into his actual thoughts and stuff. We get her point of view.
Yeah. Wait a second, Josh.
Yeah.
Are you suggesting that Hollywood people are not 100% above board?
Listen, I didn't work there as long as you. But I've read some things. Well, good job making it through those meetings is basically where I'm getting
it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, instantly when you say, like, we've had meetings about it, and I just thought, that's not going to work. And not because there's anything lacking in the story, but just because it's a lot, and it's complicated, and it's fitting that into three acts, and, that doesn't
work. Well, it wouldn't be a movie. Yeah. It would be a television show.
Good.
You know, I mean, and there was no point where I was pitching it as a movie. And this is all still an ongoing thing. So, you know, it's probably not worth talking about. But
it's a tough pitch.
Maybe.
Because if you were to ask me, I like it. I've read the whole thing. I'm following it as it goes. But, you know, if I had to put it into a boilerplate log line, that's tough.
Yeah, it's but true. That's also...
Do you have it? Like, do you have the log line? Like, how do you describe
it? Yeah, well, yeah, sure. But I'm not going to fucking trot it out for you here. I'm not your monkey. It's just that, like, I think that the weird issue about all this, though, is that you know, that thing you're saying, what is it in a log line, is not something that actually applies to you know, big, sophisticated, dramatic television shows, you know? And it just isn't. It doesn't apply to Game of Thrones. It doesn't apply, really, it doesn't even apply to Breaking Bad, because you say that it's about this one thing, about the high school teacher and the drugs, and it's not. You know, I mean, that is just an instigating incident that which all the stuff unfolds from. So, I mean, these are kind of, everybody knows that you have to sell stuff, and everybody understands that it's going to be, you know, that you have to have a simplistic way of selling things. But I don't think those simplistic ways of selling things necessarily reflect the actual series.
Yeah.
That said, it is not my, you know, we're doing our best with this and stuff, but our intention with this is to do this book. And
done too bad we got a Hugo nomination.
That is true. We did get a Hugo nomination. But the point being, just as far as the movie stuff is concerned, the Hollywood stuff is concerned, because, like, what our intention is to make this book, our intention is not to make a book that we sell as a television show. There's not, like, no matter what people actually think how this works, there actually isn't a level of financial compensation that makes this, a sole thing to try to do, you know? If you're making a book, you know, and you think you're just doing this so you could sell it so you can make a bunch of money on, you know, on whatever, the realities of this is that it doesn't really work out that way anyway.
I had a moment there where I had to be like, I know, and then I go, oh, he's not talking to me.
And so, like, I mean, it's about making this book, and in this book is the only way that we can tell this story.
Mm-hmm. And do you know what the whole story is?
Yeah.
Yep.
I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how long is this whole thing? I mean, did I read like 60?
No, it's we're saying it's 30 issues long. I mean, that could
give me a heart attack. 60.
But it, you know, I mean, that's. There are ways that it could be slightly different than that, but it's pretty well figured out to be 30 issues, six trades.
Yeah.
And are you doing, was there a break? I feel like I read you talk about this, like, early on, and now it's been long enough that I've forgotten. Was there a break? We're going to do this for a little while, take a break, come back, do it for a little while, and make sure you have time to do the whole thing. Is that the deal? Or are we just straight through now?
Very likely.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's very likely there will be a break after the third arc. There was there have been breaks in a sense, because the way that Image wants us to, you know, wants books scheduled is to have a break between them, you know, but and there was a little bit bigger of a break between the last two arcs because I got kind of stuck working on a film doing storyboards for many months longer than I expected to. So it made life a little bit difficult for getting the book done. But
we have insurance, so that's nice.
Yes, that's true. Yes, but we do have health insurance. The third arc starts in September and with issue 11, and you know that's that'll all come out normally.
And how far ahead are you at any given time? Like, are they written?
Not. I don't follow that question. What exactly are you asking?
Mumble. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, like, to me, like, the scariest, biggest part is, and I know that you're the guy who has to draw them. But the sort of the plotting and sort of as it's broken down, like, do you know what's going to happen in all the issues? Do you?
Oh yeah. Like, it's
do you script? I feel like I've asked you this personally, but like, do you do a full script or you? Or how do you?
We started out doing that,
but it's sort of like because it's all in house, if you will. It's sort of
literally.
Literally all in house. It's a little extraneous to do full scripts because we just go back and forth on it anyway, and so we kind of work it out between us, and then it's
basically drawn. Yeah, we work it out. I write a bunch of notes down on a yellow pad. We know what all the scenes are and all the and the way that it all works. This is kind of the way it's evolved too. Mm-hmm. We started out with the full scripts, and we start and it just. It just became obvious that we were doing something sort of redundant.
Mm-hmm. Well, the only thing a script is for is to communicate between the writer and the artist.
And we're both writing.
We're already doing. Yeah, it's not. We don't really need that step because. Yeah, what are you going to write? You write yourself.
Yeah, I mean, some people do. I know Joe Kubert said you had to do it that way. But I just feel like it feels. Increasingly, it felt like every time I sat down to draw it, I was reshaping all the scenes the way that they were structured, the way that they were presented, the blocking of them and everything. So it just became kind of redundant. It became a thing where we needed to sit down and figure out what's going to happen in it, and then I work on it and lay it out and figure out the way that the scene is structured, both from our writing ideas and through the way that we execute it, so that they're melded together in some way that you can either in an inextricable sort of way.
It feels to me more sculptural than a lot of I don't know, formulaic.
Yeah, and you couldn't do this if you're writing something and working with somebody on the other side of the country and you don't know them very well or whatever. Yeah, I mean, I co-write the book and I keep it all in my head all the time.
Yeah. Is it done? I mean, so is it basically done Marvel style where you're sort of plotting it out and then you're drawing it and then dialogue goes in later?
If I didn't call it Marvel style, but it is a little bit like that, but it's not like all the dialogue is just thrown in there at the last moment. Yes. We're not, we're not reshaping the story based on some artwork or something, I mean, which is, I know how that worked a lot of the time.
Now, so here's my question that I've had about it. And I saw you talking about this recently, Gabe, if your story, it was something about whether something's appropriate to be a comic book. I'm curious how you would explain that this is appropriate for being a comic book. Because it's complicated. It has a lot of human characters. A lot of it is talking and feeling. There's not a ton of action stuff, although there is some. There's explosions. There's fights with soldiers and things like that. What is it about it that makes this correct for a comic book form?
So I realize you're saying that comic readers are stupid, and that's why we can't do stuff like this. But
what about it takes advantage of visual story?
No. I think that it is because it. I mean, I'm of the opinion though that all right. I'm of the opinion you can do any. Some things are probably not suited to comics, but you can do anything if you're ambitious enough. Because it's not comics aren't necessarily. Just only at their best when there's kind of propulsive visual stuff going on, and you can reduce things down to very simple terms, visual terms that are still very, very dynamic.
RVP car stuff. Like,
Although,
I mean, just to take an extreme example of something that doesn't have a lot of traditional action.
Yeah.
I mean, Ego and Hubris is one of my favorite books, and that's
right.
all about a narcissistic dude.
Yeah. And I just don't think that you, I mean, and I think that's a kind of storytelling, though, that is, that's relying a lot more on, less on scenes and moments and being in the moment of something. And the kind of storytelling that I always want to do is about being in that moment and caring about stuff with these characters and, you know, and experiencing things with your characters, not a divorced sort of third person view of things. And I mean, I think that there's no reason not to be able to tell stories in that way. And I think that you could tell a story about, you know, a couple of people living in a house that could be dramatic and, you know, and work in all of the ways that a comic should work. And I just, you know, but it's down to being able to be a cartoonist and being able to control all of the things in the medium. It's not, you can't do it by, you know, as a factory. You couldn't do it where you just, you know, somebody writes a screenplay about a couple of people sitting around a house and then hands it off to somebody and goes, oh, figure out the cool angles for this. You know, it has to be intrinsic. The way you tell it visually intrinsically has to be part of the story. It's all the same thing. Comics are about storytelling, and the storytelling is visual as well as with the text, and those things have to meld together. So there is any version of this where the script is a completely separate thing from the art, it can be serviceable, but it's not great. Seriously, it's the only greatness in comics is when these things are absolutely melded together.
Now on this, like, where's the division of labor? Like, Corinne, are you make notes on breakdowns at this point, or, you know, not notes, but are you talking about that, or you working out the plot and then, you know, he handles the art, or you know, how does that work?
It's actually really that we sit down with a pad of paper and talk. We talk about it. Well, we talk about it a lot, just generally, and then. He makes notes as we talk about it more formally. And then after there's actual art, I'll usually take a pass at the dialogue and the diary entries. But it's only after we've already been talked about, like there's already markers for what the scene will be about, actual dialogue points. Sometimes there'll be full bits of dialogue already basically in place.
Scenes written.
Yeah.
I mean, and saying, oh, we sit down and make notes. We make a lot of notes. It's like it's not like going off and just, I'll draw something and then Stan Lee will figure it out.
Yeah. Like I'll have usually a lot more to say about the way the ecology of the planet works, because that's what I spend a lot of time thinking about. But I think really that's the only thing that I usually weigh in more heavily on.
But at every moment, if I'm drawing a scene and I'm in this scene, you know, I mean, if I'm drawing it, it's kind of like being a director and you're in the scene with these characters and you're trying to make it work. And if something feels phony, I'll just be like, you know, I'll just go upstairs or go to Karina's studio and say, you know, what this isn't right.
This isn't working. What are we going to do?
Yeah, this isn't ringing true. How are we going to fix this? How can we make this better? This is too lazy. Like we could just do this in a better way. And so and that happens all the time, all the way through it.
Mm-hmm. I'm picturing a very harmonious working arrangement. And you know, I'm married, so that seems kind of amazing.
we have conflicts, you know.
How does that work? Because basically, you've completely intertwined your personal and professional lives. You're both together in the house all the time. So you're always working on this thing. Like, is that hard?
Well, it's okay. For one thing, it's not exactly that, because Karina writes multiple other freelance jobs,
right?
And I'm a storyboard artist who gets pulled onto these dopey superhero movies occasionally. So, like, it's
And it also helps that we both have studios that are separate, mm-hmm. that have different pets in them and are arranged differently, and the doors close.
It's just funny that that's the first thing that they have different pets in them, though. First of all,
she's got a cat in her studio. And I have a rabbit in mine.
It's a very important distinction. But I found also that I need a day out of the house to do something completely unrelated. So I always put a day aside during the week to do volunteer work, mm-hmm. just to kind of clear my head.
And like, so do you guys ever do things where you're like, okay, we're not going to talk about this here?
We try and it never works.
Yeah, we try. I don't have discipline. When it comes to that, it's virtually every sentence out of my mouth is, I know we're not supposed to be talking about this.
Yeah, that's true.
But
that's true.
I have this idea.
The closest I can liken that to is if I do get a night out, we'll be like, let's just not talk about the kids.
Right. It's a little like that.
It's got to be a lot like that.
It is.
And then you're talking about pets and animals. I want a diversion now, because I want to talk to me about the pets and animals and the coterie of wildlife that you live with, because I feel like it's pretty expansive.
Yeah, we've got 7.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I mean, we have four cats, we have a dog, we have four cats, we have a bird,
I love a bird, a
fish,
bunny.
And a bunny. Yeah. But we just like animals.
And is that both of you? And has that always been the case?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You had a cat when I moved in with you.
Yeah.
And then in short order, I found another cat. So
it's just, you know, it's kind of grown, but we've gotten a bigger house. So what can you do?
It's good. It's good. I like it very much. It seems like a nice atmosphere, except when they get sick, and then it throws everything off.
Which is constantly. Really, there are constantly. Too many of them. They're constantly sick. So
that's,
you know,
not true. We take very good care of our guys.
And they still are constantly sick because there's too many of them.
Well, but some of them are rather elderly.
It is what it is.
You know, I want to go backwards a little bit. Because the first time you started working together after Heathentown, you did a series of licensed properties, which sounds so strange when we're sort of talking about all these other things that are going on, but I specifically remember talking to you two in San Diego, and you were both very excited. You were like, we're going to do Planet of the Apes.
I loved working on Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, it was so where did that, were you trying to get that?
No.
Well, kind of.
No, not really. I mean, only in that, like, literally, I had done something for Boom that I can't remember now. Like,
we talked to them at the book festival.
Right, but it literally was, we ran into the people from Boom at the LA, you know, like the UCLA book festival, and they were going to do a Planet of the Apes book, and I, you know, and we were just talking to somebody from there, and I was like, hey, let us do a Planet of the Apes one shot. And they're like, okay.
How about a miniseries?
How about a miniseries? We're like, okay. And that's kind of how it happened. I mean, it was not a big plan. And I mean, I think that the, you know, all of the business of what is, you know, what seems like it's a good thing to do and what, you know, and what's an exciting thing to do. I mean, I at that time was working on the highest profile thing I ever did for Marvel, just drawing it on Secret Avengers.
But you weren't writing it.
I wasn't writing it, and it was not a good experience. And so looking at
all the blonde superhero men.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the death of visual storytelling. Every single character being a blonde guy who looks exactly the same. But the just this frivolous sort of thing of, hey, well, I mean, like, it's of, hey, we'll write a Planet of the Apes comic. You know, like, it's so dopey, you know, and of a thing to do. Yet, like, when, you know, and it was just a tossed off idea that we would do it. But then when they came back to us and was like, well, why don't you just do, you know, why don't you just do like a 4-issue miniseries? We sat down to do it. It was like, holy shit, this is the kind of thing that the stories we really like to tell. Like, it was all about you know, this kind of gray moral stuff and the politics
might sound a little familiar,
you know, about you know, I mean, there's the animal aspect of it, but really that was sort of it was kind of flipped, because in the world of that, the apes are sort of like the people, and the people are more like treated like animals.
And I did work with orangutans and chimpanzees at the LA Zoo. I was the manager of two different projects looking at ape behavior.
Yeah. So I mean, all of these everything in the world, especially in the pop culture world, is based on these preconceptions. And like, people who do real work are not working based on preconceptions. You're getting in there and you're going, what's the story we have to tell? And when we got into this and we start digging into it, it's like, this is the kind of story we want to tell. And it was, you know, and like, you know, we had already thought about Invisible Republic at that point. We were worried about cannibalizing things that we had thought of from Invisible Republic. But, like, the weirdest thing about doing some licensed Planet of the Apes comic is that absolutely no one told us we couldn't do something. We did everything we wanted to do. And we were, you know, and we tried to stay true to the world of it. And we were able to, you know, to tell a story in the way we wanted to tell it, do it in a... you know, write a freelance thing for the first time together, and figure out how to do it and how to accomplish that. And then, you know, I only drew the first 4-issue miniseries, then got to work with Mark Lamming on the second miniseries.
It was amazing.
And then, you know, and work with other artists and be able to, you know, to kind of just get paid to, you know, to figure out how to do all that sort of shit.
Well, and plus there are a lot of characters that we could play with that were much more recognizable as people to me, even though they were apes. There were women who were scientists and cared passionately about their work. And, you know, I know a lot of people like that. And there was room for friendship between women and, you know, morally ambiguous retired soldiers. And there was a lot more space to develop the type of stories we wanted to tell.
And it's a world where there aren't heroes.
Right.
It's not about heroes. It's not about about people who are held to some particular moral standard or thought to be. And that's an exciting thing for telling a story.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at that and I look at Star Wars that comes after it, it really does seem of a piece with Invisible Republic. It's your voices. You know, it's visually, obviously, sort of, it's visually the same. It's I find that really interesting.
Well, the Star Wars one was very similar because it was at Dark Horse, and it was at a point before, well, actually the selling Lucasfilm to Disney happened right when we were doing the book, but there was no impact of it while we were doing the book. And,
but it just meant that we knew we had an end point.
Yeah. We knew that it was going to run out at some point, but we were able to just, because, you know, we worked with Randy Stradley there, who had been doing Star Wars comics forever, and it was something where we had these couple of parameters laid out. I mean, there were things that we would have done differently if it had not been the, you know, building on everything that had already been happening in the comics world of Star Wars before then. You know, there were certainly things we would have just clarified about the politics of it. But
there were some things that we weren't allowed to clarify because we were doing things with the novels and other places where we weren't allowed to go there because somebody else was already treading that ground.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a weird kind of frustration with it. But basically, we were just able to, you know, to tell the story and try to tell it about, you know, and I think there's actually a bit more heroism and earnestness in our Star Wars book, but that's
well, the tone is totally different.
The tone is different. Star Wars is a more simplistic universe, and I mean, I don't think that's a bad thing.
There are heroes in Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So now, Karina, from those, you sort of launched into doing, you didn't sort of, you did, you launched into doing some freelance work on your own, writing under just your own name.
Uh-huh.
Was that something you were going for to try to write comics on your own, or is that like a nice happenstance also?
Yeah, well, at a certain point, I had a really unbelievably horrible commute to my zookeeper job, and at a certain point, it was kind of like, well, I can spend more time writing, or I can spend this time in the car. So I had to kind of pick one, And my zookeeper job, I knew had a lifespan on it just because of where the zoo was. So I picked comics. And that was probably a good choice because it felt like at the time, oh, my God, what have I done? I've gone completely freelance. And I'd never done that in my life before. We'd always only had one freelancer.
Right. Yeah. No. Who, yeah. Yeah.
You know, of course, working with animals does not make a lot of money. So it's not like I was taking a pay cut in any way, shape or form, as long as I kept getting jobs. But I did. So happily, I just kept getting jobs. Like, I've done a lot of work for Dynamite. I really like working with Dynamite and some other stuff with Dark Horse, and did two different Once Upon a Time adaptations.
Well, you're a master of licensed properties now.
So. Yeah. I don't actually have anything against licensed properties. I know a lot of people, they get kind of a bad rap, but I find it kind of fascinating to work in somebody else's universe and really try to make it feel like that property.
Well, you've got like a model to work with, and then you can do something really cool within those limitations, which is, I guess, very attractive.
Well, it's not, I mean, the utterly artificial distinction between Marvel and DC books and licensed books. I mean, it's the same thing. There's a big, you know, I mean, Marvel and DC books are licensed corporate books that don't, you know, that have very specific structures that you have to follow. It's, I mean, the differences are very minimal.
It's true, but they have been designed around a certain comic book superhero story, which, say, you know, an episodic television show or something isn't really the same form. So you have to transmute it into that other thing. It's,
yeah, but I mean, I think,
and the proof of that is that very often it does not work.
Sure, but tell me what, I mean, do you think that very often anything works? You know, I mean, it's, you know, vast majority of things don't work. The vast majority of superhero comics or anything don't work.
But Marvel comics kind of are what they are. And if you were the audience for those Marvel comics, you go, okay, and you just keep buying them. And as long as they're not offensive, and well, even then,
but I'm saying if the
audience for them keeps going after them, same thing with the television
special
show.
Special pleading. It's work, and the work is either good or not good. The work is made by people. There are no universes. There's no nothing. There are stories. The stories are told by people, and they're either good or bad.
I remember, I want to say the mid-2000s, the comics publishers were just getting into this idea that they would do comics of television shows. And I don't remember who did it, but somebody did a comic series of The Shield. And I remember I read the first one because I was like, I'm into The Shield. And I just remember, it was so wrong. It was just awful, and nothing worked.
But that's, I mean, there's also a lot of different reasons why something could be a good or bad story, and, you know, in a different form.
Bad.
I mean, And being a highly serialized television show that's you know, that's on at the same time is a really bad idea for a comic. Doing something that's doing something that, like, I mean, all of the things that like all the licensed books that I was involved with in any way were things that mostly were able to just kind of exist on their own.
Yeah, like we did Planet of the Apes before the new movies.
Yeah, so. and the ones
and
we
you
did
got out of Star Wars just in time.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
well, I mean, it's not an incredibly appealing idea to be a part of, like, something that has some people sitting off in a smoke filled room coming up with all the stories, and then you're supposed to execute that.
So I'm going back to Karina. Your work, when you're working on something on your own, how is it different than the work that you do with Gabe?
It's funny. We've talked about this. I think a lot of times stuff I write tends to go more towards horror or, like, dark supernatural stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you're working, like Kinski turns out to be more real world kind of, I don't know, a little bit more
uncomfortable people stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, I think that's the major distinction. And somehow when those things collide, you get Invisible Republic.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, recently I did a Aliens Vampirella crossover. And I loved it. That was right up my alley. I love Alien. And it was really fun to write Vampirella. And that was like a kind of a perfect collision of properties for me, because I could do what I wanted with it mostly, but I still had to work hard to make it feel correct. But I had a good feeling for both of those things. So
you get that offer. And what is your first instinct? I mean, I assume that somebody asked you about it. You didn't pitch it.
No. Actually, my editor, Joe Rybrandt, came up with that idea like that. It was a crossover between Dynamite and Dark Horse, because they each have, Vampirella's with Dynamite, right, and Aliens is with Dark Horse. But so he's like, well, here's these two things that need to meet in the middle. Do you have any ideas? And I thought about it, and I went, oh, yeah, I have ideas.
And I think that a lot of people, like, for that, I remember every single person going, well, that makes no sense. Vampirella and Aliens couldn't ever fit together. And, like, I remember thinking, even, like, I mean, you talked to me about it, and I remember thinking, I could kind of picture how that would work. Like, and there are so many things that I can't picture how that would work.
Like, I think that was a great idea to put together.
But even just, not just the from space. Like, you say you take, Star Trek and Green Lantern and put them together. It's like they come from such tonally different worlds. Like the tone of the world of Green Lantern versus the tone of the world of Star Trek don't, in my head, seem to fit together at all. But if the two things have a kind of common tone, I can kind of imagine that.
Well, another problem can be if they're too similar. Like, I've also recently written a Tarzan-Sheena crossover. Mm-hmm. And they're both very, they both love their jungle homes, and they're both very action-oriented, and they're animal sidekicks. And in a way, that had a whole different challenge, because you had to make them seem different. Mm-hmm. And I don't like it when people just fight for no reason, just to make drama without a point. So I didn't want it to be a thing like they're fighting with each other all the time, but how do you make them work on a problem together but still be distinct individuals? But with Aliens Vampirella, there was no problem, because those are both different enough that, she thinks she's a monster, but she's a thinking monster, and they're, kind of colonial, maybe they think, but in a way so foreign to us. So that was actually a really fun puzzle to solve.
So that one, like, when you hear that, your instinct was, like, what's the first thing are you the kind of person who says, yeah, I can work on that, or are you like, oh, God, I don't know how I'm going to do that, and then you have to work on it for a little bit, or, because my instinct is if I heard something, we're going to put these two things together, my first instinct would be, I can't let them know that I have no idea how this would work.
Well, honestly, for that one, it was an easy yes, because I went, Alien? Yes.
Yeah, I can see that.
And I had a couple of different, I think I pitched three different possibilities, and we ended up with the one that took place on Mars, which is great, because I've been reading a ton about Mars. But there are other things where I have to kind of think about it. And if there was something that I really had no feeling for, I would say no, because that's just not fair to the property.
And we've also pitched freelance things together that have been, where we'll start on it and it seems like, well, maybe we can make this work. Yeah. And then it really didn't over the course of it.
Right.
I mean, and like, there've been things like that. And my work circumstances made it so that I haven't been able to, I've only really focused on Invisible Republic, but it's, it's there's really nothing stopping me from writing freelance stuff as well. It's just that my workload in movies plus writing or drawing Invisible Republic as well makes it time-wise very difficult.
And you'd probably rather spend it. I mean, why, if you can do your own, create your own stuff, why, it's
To be in the most minor way taken as if I'm actually a writer in comics? Well, whatever.
Is that
having an argument over here, and Josh is just uncomfortable on the other side of the mic.
That's the thing. You want to be a writer, and you draw also, but
it's not that I want to be a writer.
I know. I realized when I said it.
I've only been drawing things I write for 5 years.
I know that. I could not picture you going back to doing the other things in that sense. And I'm going to get to that because I do want to talk about Kinski, and I want to go there. I am curious about one other thing. So you two have been working together. When you have to do a script for somebody else, Karina, how does that work for you?
You know, it was definitely a learning curve. I mean, I was fortunate in that Gabriel's so versed in storytelling that, like, when I wrote Heathen Town, we both worked on it, and it was a, you know, the script was a Frankenstein's monster because I didn't really know what I was doing as far as formally writing a script. But as, you know, going through Planet of the Apes and stuff like that and working together, and we had to produce scripts that not only an editor could read, but also, you know, multiple other people could make sense out of. So at this point, I have a pretty good, like, by the time I was just doing stuff that was just my own stuff, like Aliens, Vampirella or whatever, I have a pretty good workflow that is my personal way of doing something that's a little different than when we work together. Yeah. Although I'm always tinkering with it, and I don't know, it's never quite to my satisfaction, but you're definitely my beta reader on everything, so.
Yeah, I mean, I usually read the stuff, and if some, I mean, it's, you know, so just as an artist, I can say, oh, this isn't clear enough. This action should be a little clearer, you know, just so that, you know, so that the artist will know.
Yeah, because my visual sense has definitely developed a lot since I started doing this work, but I still think in words.
Yeah, and I have a lot of opinions about visual storytelling, and I say them all the time.
That's true.
I've heard that.
But it's good because a lot of times, like, I've worked with artists who, you know, English isn't their first language, and I tend to be really verbose, and sometimes what's needed is simplicity, and sometimes somebody needs to tell me, don't say it that way.
Do you find that you have adopted some of Gabe's rules and some of those kind of styles, so that if you're working with somebody else who has a different style, it's, or do you think, well, that's not right?
I don't know. I'm perhaps less opinionated than some.
I mean, we all are.
On
a scale.
But you don't, it's mostly, it's just about clear storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I kind of feel like with the script, there are certain things that need to get into the script for the clarity of the story. So, like, when it's just me writing, the story is the story, and there's things that need to be there so that everyone can understand the story. How somebody else interprets that and puts it on the page, I mean, it's a collaboration, so it's never going to end up being exactly what I pictured, which is probably good because, again, my visual language is not as refined as an artist would be, and every artist is different. So when I'm collaborating with somebody else, it just turns out a lot different. But that's cool because it's a different thing, you know.
Yeah,
it's
that's
different.
Fun. Now, I do want to talk about Kinski because and it's kind of funny because my thought originally was, how do you describe this? Because it's fairly simple. And then you said something earlier which was just uncomfortable human stories, and I was like, yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where did that come? I guess I want. Can you explain what it is? Because I can't. I think I can, but I want to hear how you explain it, and then let me know where that came from.
It's a sort of quirky crime story about a traveling salesman who steals a dog, thinking he's doing it for I haven't done this for a while, thinking that he's saving the dog from its cruel owners, and that ends up sort of ruining his life for a while.
And also defining it, though.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and there's a cathartic element to it. But it's a sort of quirky, I say a quirky Coen Brothers-esque sort of thing. That's not really true, but it's a thing that people can kind of connect with.
Do you consider the guy the main character? The guy who finds the dog?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
I see. One of the things that was interesting about that is that he, and this isn't a criticism, I think I could never tell where he was coming from. And I was like, wait, is he being a good guy here? Or is he being a, and then I was like, oh, he's neither. And he doesn't know. And we don't know. And that for me is where my discomfort came from. Again,
right.
Not bad discomfort, but I was like, you're not giving me what I'm used to having.
Yeah, I mean, if you're reading the book and you don't have discomfort, I have failed. You know, I mean, that's the intention, you know? I mean, the intention is to present you with a guy who makes decisions that you could argue a lot of different ways, you know? I mean, it's about this kind of morally ambiguous situation.
No heroes.
Yeah. I mean, he makes a decision that, that's incredibly uncomfortable, to basically to steal a dog from a child because he thinks the dog is not well taken care of.
Just that sentence is uncomfortable.
And the rest of it is all of the fallout from that decision and the continued poor choices he makes. Although he decides he was wrong very early and sets about trying to fix it and just makes more problems. So, I mean, it's, you know, these are the kind of stories that I'm interested in. I mean, like, if me personally, the kind of stories I'm deeply interested in are about flawed characters who are trying to, try to do the right thing and don't necessarily have the skills to do the right thing and make messes of their lives. But, but that doesn't mean that, I mean, Kinski has an arc to it, and he and Joe, the main character, is going someplace with this. It's not just all about existential misery or whatever. It's also a goofy comic about running around with a dog.
And what's the disclaimer that's so important?
Oh, the dog doesn't die.
I don't see you doing that.
No.
Oh, God, no.
I don't think you do that.
But I've had this over and over again where people are afraid to read the book because they think that I'm going to do something to the dog.
Only no, the dog is, well, the dog is overly loved. That's the one thing you do have going for you. Well, the dog is okay.
Yeah.
So that's fine. The uncomfortableness plus the title makes me think of Werner Herzog in ways that I don't fully understand. Is that intentional?
Yeah. I mean, it's intentional in that, there's not some big meta thing to it, really. It is really just that, that they named the dog Kinski on a lark and, because the dog seems to be crazy, like Klaus Kinski. And it's not that much deeper than that. You know, it's not like I don't really believe in that kind of meta storytelling. I think that it's all in the story.
Although I imagine if you read Burden of Dreams, you discover that Herzog's no stranger to pursuing an obsession to unbelievably.
Yeah. All right, so there's a little bit of meta stuff in it.
Yeah, it's there. There's definitely. I could hear him narrating it for some reason. He's made another poet choice.
But if you're talking about why is Invisible Republic a comic? If there's a lot of character driven stuff and it's a lot of, it's not necessarily all about a big action and you could say the same thing about Kinski. Why is that a comic if it's not, if there's not, big production value things in it and explosions and whatever. But I'm dying to dive deeper than Kinski and do books that are less, that are even less obviously apparently comics and will sell even less than Kinski did.
You're just a commercial force. So, I mean, you're going to be working on Invisible Republic for the foreseeable future. Like, or do you have like an end date? I feel like if you're, is 10 or 11 is out now?
11, it comes out in September. That's okay. The beginning of the third arc. So,
and the second trade is out really soon.
Second trade is out. Well, probably will already be out by the time people are listening to this. Mm-hmm. And I honestly can't keep those dates in my head. We're working on the third arc now, and there will be three more arcs after that. There's a possibility that there will be a break in between them, just for sanity and whatever reasons.
But you've got at least 2-3 years.
Yeah. Well, probably not 3 years, but probably 2 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you'll have that other weird story that is even less commercial, just dying to break out at that point.
Yeah, I'll be trying to work on that at the same time so that I can.
Oh, I think there's a couple of them.
Oh, yeah, I've got loads of them, you know, and, you know, it probably is if it's, you know, comics are an odd thing because they're genre-wise, they are very typed to a particular kind of thing, but there's plenty of...
It's a medium, not a genre.
Yeah, and so it's, there's plenty of novels and movies and all sorts of stuff out there that, you know, that explore different kinds of stuff and the kind of stuff that I'm trying to explore in Kinski. And, you know, they're probably not that popular in those mediums either, you know, but I think it's very valid and, you know, and where I draw a lot of inspiration.
Cool. I look forward to all of that stuff very much. That's not even, that's not even like me being nice. I really am looking forward to those things because, it's unique. It's something that's different. And we always need more of that. Is there anything else coming out? I guess, Karina, do you have other stuff that's coming out in the near future that we should be on the lookout for?
Gosh, I think, currently my run on Miss Fury is wrapping up. That's going to be out in trade in November, I believe. Just had a giant book come out from, Insight that I co-wrote with Landry Walker from a story by it's basically like a sideshow production for their Court of the Dead line. So that just came out. That's like a giant coffee table book that's beautiful and full of art and prose and crazy stuff. And then Aliens Vampirella just came out in trade, and Lords of the Jungle, which is the Tarzan Sheena crossover, is just now wrapping up, and that's going to be out in trade by Christmas. And gosh, what else is there?
I'm not sure. That might be it that you can talk about now.
Yeah.
Also, we're going to do a superhero comic. So, you know.
Try not to sell it too hard. I don't want everyone to get
No. We're very likely doing a freelance thing as well that we can't talk about yet.
And this is you drawing and you both writing?
Yep.
All right. I look forward to that.
Something else soon that will be announced from me, and it seems like I'm forgetting something, but I don't. Yeah.
my little sarcasm thing about the superhero thing, it was a joke, okay? Like if you look at the stuff that I've drawn and, you know, the stuff that I've written and drawn, you know that I have zero regard for what I should be doing. I'm only interested in the thing that excites me. And if we're doing a freelance thing, then it's a project that excites me, that I'm interested in and really want to do.
Okay, so if I asked you right now, what would be the superhero thing that would really excite you? Is this it, or is there a different answer that you can give me? I'll give that question to both of you.
So the end of this thing is, what superhero do we want to do?
I have a good answer for that. I already I just did a 5-issue run on Miss Fury, and that was what I really wanted to do.
So there you go. But can we just talk about it for 1 second though? This is a weird question in a way, because like if I looked at it like, what superhero did I always like? Do I want to do that? That's not necessarily an effective way to think of this, right? I mean, I don't know, the Doom Patrol, right? I was a fan of that Morrison Doom Patrol. I was also really a fan of the 60s Doom Patrol, the Arnold Drake, Bruno Premiani Doom Patrol. Bruno Premiani, the artist, is one of my top guys of all time. I love his work. And, but... that doesn't mean that somehow now doing a Doom Patrol book makes any sense, you know?
No, but if you come at me with saying, you know, that we're doing a superhero book and you make a joke about it, then I have to ask you, is there a superhero book that would excite you? And again,
the point I'm making is that it's not necessarily, I wouldn't necessarily be able to answer that way, you know? Like there's a, the best projects are probably the things that, that I haven't even necessarily thought about, you know, like it's about being presented, you know, like if you're doing a freelance thing, it's about being presented with this thing and realizing that you really do have a story to tell in that mm-hmm. world or with that character. And I don't think that that aligns with I always loved that character. You know, I mean, I think that I'm sure there are a lot of people who just really, really want to work on a particular character and that's
I think it's different than love that character. I think there's a I could tell a story about this guy or
whoever. Right. That doesn't necessarily line up with I always loved that character, you know.
No, I don't think
so. I tell a story about him isn't the same thing as I love the stories other people have told. Mm-hmm. So I mean if you said like this isn't what we're doing, but like say Hawkman mm-hmm. seems like kind of a dopey character, right? But when I think about it and I think about, well, you know, he's got space and they've got some other planet and there's rules on those planets. They've probably got some pretty strict rules on that planet. And, you know, and he, you know, and all of the things that go along with that, I start thinking, you know, I'd probably like to do a Hawkman book.
Well, I think some of it comes from also once you've thought about the character for a little while. And like, I didn't expect to really like writing Hulk, but when we worked on the Hulk book, it was
great. Yeah, we did like a two issue Hulk Doctor Strange mm-hmm. thing. And, you know, we cast it as a sort of science fiction story and, it, you know, kind of mystical science fiction story. And we're able to find a way in. And it, you know, it just isn't necessarily about, you know, here's that guy, you know, I've always loved this guy. I got to tell one more story of this guy. I mean, I like Batman fine, but I'm not convinced there needs to ever be another Batman story. There've been a billion of them.
I don't disagree. But I still have to read them all.
No disrespect to the people doing the job now.
I understand.
You know, at all, you know?
Are there any, like, do you guys read any comics?
Oh, yeah.
What the fuck?
I'm asking. It's not just me. Like is there current stuff that's coming out that is like, oh, that's really good work. And the other side of that, because there's two ways to appreciate comics, I think. There's the, wow, they're doing a really good job on this craft. You know, the art looks great. The story is good, whatever. And then there's the, I'm actually really into the story and I'm enjoying it. And I find that's harder to come by the longer I've been reading superhero stories.
I don't think those are different things. I think it's the same thing. I think you are, if the craft is working, you're enjoying the story. And I can't imagine another way for it to work. I mean, the comics, like one of the absolute best comics coming out now is Gorillaz.
Oh, I love Gorillaz. Gorillaz is amazing.
What's his name? Bram Revell?
Yeah, Bram Revell. Mm-hmm.
Yep. That is just a masterpiece of visual craftsmanship and storytelling and doing something that on the surface of it sounds silly and is not in any way and is taken, you know, and deconstructed and told in this, you know, really, you know, really great, interesting way. Like I read that book and I'm like, shit, I should be doing a much better job of this stuff.
That's great. I'm really glad you got a place to bring that and finish it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I've been waiting for that for...
Yeah, I think he started that book when we put out Heathentown.
You know,
I think they came out...
Right.
The very beginning of Gorillaz when we did Heathentown.
I met him at a party, and like I was talking about it, and he looked at me like, you've read it? And I was like, yes. You know, and that was a really long time ago. Yeah,
but there's a bunch of there's lots of stuff, you know. I mean, the recent Daniel Klaus book was great.
Oh yeah, that was really good. Also, Lazarus. I just have finally gotten caught up with that.
That's a very nice bookend to your book. I think that happens at the same time at Image.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like I've heard people say that, and I was way behind. And then I kind of see what they're saying, though, because it's a lot about the interpersonal politics, and it's science fiction, but in service of the more interesting story that's going around.
And a different spin on sort of what can happen to a society that was like ours.
And there's a lot of really interesting ideas in there that I just would have never even occurred to me, but are fascinating to read.
Yeah, he goes for it. Cool. I think that's about all that I have for you. And I think we talked about what's coming up. Anything to add? Are we good?
I think
we're good.
Yeah.
I think I just stole that from Mark Maron without meaning to.
Oh, well, you know.
Well, now you have to get a camera.
You're a podcaster.
I was first, man.
No.
I don't have to tell you. I remember early on, I used to think I should write to that guy and talk to him. And then he kept getting bigger and bigger. And I was like, I guess I missed my chance.
But we still see him down at the local coffee shop every once in a while. He lives in our neighborhood. So.
Have you ever seen him get mad at anybody at that coffee shop?
I'm not hanging around watching Mark Maron, okay? Like, I'm good. We've got lives to live.
Listen, you guys brought it up. I don't. All right, well, thanks very much. That was super fun. And I'm glad that happened.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you.
And that is all. I want to thank Gabe and Karina for spending all that time with me and talking about comics and all of the other things that came up. You can comment on this over at ifanboy.com and see what's going on and the other stuff that we've got going on there. You can follow Gabe and Karina on Twitter. That's probably the best place for them. And again, check out patreon.com/ifanboy to help support the show if you like this kind of thing. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you later.
That's for you.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means, and I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing, and some people, you know, like, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away, and, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which, again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened. But it can be tough to deal with. And also, like, one of the things is, like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.